We live in a world where 26 billionaires own as much wealth as half the planet's population. In the U.S. alone, the three wealthiest men control more resources than the bottom half of America combined, a total of 160 million people. While a majority of Americans favor a more equitable distribution of wealth, the $64,000 question is, how do you achieve that? It is a question that is addressed in the new book, The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few, by Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard of the Democracy Collaborative. It's a pleasure to welcome Marjorie Kelly to the roundtable this morning. Marjorie, thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thanks for having me.
The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. How did you come to this particular question and look to solve it?
Yeah, Joe, well, I'm Executive Vice President at the Democracy Collaborative, and we do this work. We've been around about 20 years as a nonprofit with 40 people working around the country. So we've been helping communities build prosperity for those who've been excluded. And we thought it's time to share the lessons that we've learned and to show lots of people, thousands of people have been working at what is essentially a new economic paradigm. There's impact investing, there's employee-owned firms, there's state-owned banks, there's lots of, you know, economic development that's inclusive of racial and gender disparities. So lots of incredible work has been happening by brilliant people all over. And what we do in the book is we say, you know, this is really a new paradigm. It's a way to organize an economy that is for all of us and not just for the few of us. So what we do in the book is we talk about where's this happening? Where are the journeys? We can go see the people who are doing this work, talk about their struggles. So we're trying to show that you know, we're told that capitalism is the only system there is and there's no alternative, or we, for some reason, think there's this binary choice between corporate capitalism and state socialism. And, you know, in fact, there's this new paradigm coming up that includes elements of both of those. And so that's what we're talking about.
So I want to talk to you about this future and about this paradigm that you mentioned. I do, of course, want to first address how we got here. So there are many ways of asking this question, and the way I will choose to do it is, was there ever a time, are we looking to get back to something, or are we looking to create something new? In other words, we have never achieved true economic equality.
Yeah, you're right. We're reaching for something new. So the way we put it is that society long ago democratized government, but we have never democratized the economy. What has instead been done is to leave in place this system which is designed to create wealth for the few, and we've hedged it around with social safety nets and regulations to try to make it work for everybody. But it's gotten out of control. It's like putting a picket fence in front of a bulldozer. The system is basically flattening the regulations and social safety nets. And so it's time to say, well, what if we brought the values of democracy inside the economy, inside investing, inside companies, inside economic development? So that's what we need to do at this point.
And do you feel that is achievable? I mean, what does it take to get to that point?
It's definitely achievable. And so this is why we go and we visit real places. So I'll tell you a story, for example, of EA Engineering. This is an environmental consulting firm in Maryland. It was founded by a biologist, and its goal is to help create a better environment. At one point, this company was traded on NASDAQ. It went public. Its shares traded on NASDAQ. It virtually destroyed the company because it took them off their mission of building a better environment, and it made them say, no, your mission now is to produce quarterly earnings. And the founder stepped in, bought it back. He turned it into a 100% employee-owned company and a benefit corporation, which is a state incorporation framework in place in 34 states. And he said, you know, so we're owned by our employees now, and our mission is to balance profit with public benefit. The company's been successful ever since. It's a $140 million company with 500 employees. So yes, and there's lots of these companies out there. It is possible, and I could cite lots more examples, Joe, but this is the work that we've been seeing for 20 years, and it's off the radar for most people, but believe me, this it's highly sophisticated. People know how to do this stuff.
All right, so with that in mind, what does a democratic economy look like?
Yeah, so what it looks like is we have an economy that's designed in its DNA, in its institutions, and in the way assets are held and used, and it's designed for the benefit of all of us and to function within planetary boundaries. So that looks like companies that have broad-based ownership, and they have a commitment to serving the public good as well as being profitable. It means economic development that is recognizes racial disparities that have been there for decades and longer, and working to change that. We look at Portland, Oregon, how economic development there has completely oriented itself toward racial and gender inclusion, and how there's a young black man we talked to who was formerly homeless, and then he became Oregon Entrepreneur of the Year because the economic development of the city helped him. Investing that's done for both social and ecological impact and for financial returns. All of these things, so the values come inside economic activities, and they're not just wrapped around the outside.
In talking about the system that we have in our current economic system, you say a first principle of that system is capital bias. So what are some of the first principles of this democratic economy?
Yeah, so community is a really key first principle. That this is, and we talked to a Native American man who's building a regenerative community on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which has high poverty, and it's designed to help the community to flourish. And you know, solar energy, an employee-owned construction company, and so his aim is very different than that of the guys from Silicon Valley who are out to make themselves billionaires, even though one in three children in their own neighborhoods go hungry. So community, that's a key one. Sustainability, you know, we have to have a flourishing planet or nothing else is going to work. Inclusion, we need to recognize racial bias has been in our economy for since the founding and work deliberately on that. Place. How do you bring our economy back down to the real world and not this hypothetical globalized economy? We look at how anchor institutions and nonprofit hospitals, universities are relocalizing their purchasing, hiring, and investment to benefit their communities, and democratic ownership and ethical finance. So those are the kinds of principles that are being built into economic activity.
You mentioned something a moment ago that I just jotted down, and you were talking about this movement for a democratic economy and saying much of this work is going below the radar. Why do you think that is the case, that so much of it is not more touted?
Yes, you know, that's really the key question, Joe. I think it's a cultural issue. I mean, why did we think for centuries that history was all about men and what men are doing and it's what great men are doing? Well, there was a bias there. It was sex bias, gender bias. And capital bias is right now in the lens of how we look at the economy. What do we talk about? We talk about Wall Street. You know, where are companies owned? We're all investing in publicly traded companies. They're on Wall Street. You know, they're nationalized. I can't hardly invest in a company that might be right next door to me. So it's designed into the economy that it's all about capital. And so there's a lot of things that we miss as a result. I mean, impact investing, for example, and socially responsible investing, that's been around for 30 years, and yet people keep discovering it as though it's something new. It's not. It's tens of billions of dollars are being invested in very sophisticated ways. Employee-owned companies, Ronald Reagan put in place generous tax incentives for founders who sell to employees, and yet employee ownership is just kind of off the radar screen of people because we don't think this way.
In this work, as you say, that's been going on for some 20 years, how is it setting up the infrastructure for other communities to replicate it?
Okay, so I'll give you an example. One of the places we visit in the book, it's Cooperative Home Care Associates. This company's been around for, I think, 33 years. These are mostly low-income Latina and African-American women. They go out and care for Medicaid, low-income people in their homes, their home health care aides. This company employs 1,200. It's completely owned by its workers. It's a worker-centered company. There's now a movement to replicate this. There's 15 worker-owned home care companies that are either in existence or in development. So that's one example. Employee ownership in general is being replicated. There are a half dozen states now have centers for employee ownership. Massachusetts just funded its this year. And the governor of Colorado has just created an office of employee ownership inside his own administration. City of New York has spent millions of dollars to fund the creation of employee ownership. So there's lots of work going on that could take employee ownership to scale. So that's one example.
I am curious because you have given many examples, but bring us to Cleveland, Ohio. You point out this is a city with 24% unemployment, 39% poverty, and one of the poorest large cities in the country. Yet, you also say that they have a flourishing democratic economy. This is the Cleveland model. I'm hoping you will tell us about it and the success that this has had.
Joe, this is such a great example. Yeah, our organization, the Democracy Collaborative, helped design and start the Evergreen Cooperatives in Cleveland, along with lots of other great people there in Cleveland. But Cleveland, at one time, was a very prosperous city. It had more Fortune 500 firms than any place except New York. And then businesses fled. White people fled. It lost half its population. And left behind in the very center of Cleveland were large anchor institutions, Cleveland Clinic, Case Western Reserve University. They're not going to get up and leave. They're anchored in place. And they said, how can we use our resources to benefit our community? And one of the things they did is they helped fund the startup of three worker-owned companies. They brought them large contracts. One of them is a laundry, Evergreen Laundry. It now does the laundry, all the laundry for Cleveland Clinic, for example. It's a worker-owned company. It hires the formerly incarcerated from these beaten-down neighborhoods that surround these anchor institutions. There's a greenhouse that's employee-owned, and it sells, you know, basil and lettuce to large anchors. So we can use our resources in our own communities to benefit the people of those communities. We do a lot of work with anchor institutions, and there's a movement all around the country for this kind of work.
Do healthcare facilities, in this case the Cleveland Clinic, do they make good anchor institutions?
They do. Most people don't realize most hospitals in this country are nonprofit owned. These are large institutions. They can be billions of dollars in revenue. And there's a movement among them to take care of what they call the social determinants of health. There's a recognition that health doesn't just come from, you know, seeing the doctor or being at the hospital. It comes from, do you have good food? Do you have enough to eat? Do you have a safe neighborhood to live in? And so hospital systems are beginning to look into their communities and do some economic development, investing, hiring, purchasing, to help their local communities thrive. So that's one example of how this work is finding some real clout. Hospitals and universities together are about 9% of GDP. That's a lot if you can orient that toward local communities.
In the example that you gave about Cleveland and the Cleveland model and talking about these anchor institutions, you mentioned the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry.
Mm-hmm.
This obviously benefits the workers, but you also make the point that there are many others that benefit from such ventures.
Well, that's right. So the idea isn't let's turn workers into new capitalists and they benefit while everyone else around them doesn't. No, the evergreen co-ops are deliberately designed to benefit the community. There's a portion of their profits that goes into a fund that's going to start new worker-owned companies. And there's three worker-owned companies that are part of evergreen cooperatives, and they're anchored in the community. They're not going to get up and leave. They're not going to be sold, to some big corporation and take that money for just the existing owners. So yes, they're deliberately rooted in community, and they have a purpose of helping that community.
When it comes to the jobs, however, that are provided, how secure are they?
That's one of the real benefits of worker ownership. There are studies that show that worker-owned firms, workers there are one-fourth as likely to be laid off. In a downturn, they'll redistribute the work. Maybe people will cut their own hours, but they'll deliberately try to save jobs rather than just throwing people off the bus, which often happens in a capital-centered firm. And yes, at Evergreen, those are pretty secure jobs. They not only have their income as from wages, but then they have this nice retirement security of the asset ownership when they retire. I mean, 47% of Americans, Joe, don't have even $400 they can put together in an emergency. So people are very insecure. But if you have a little bit of a nest egg, you're going to have much more financial security.
Democratic presidential candidates are talking about the democratic economy. I assume this can only be a good thing.
It's a great thing. You know, we're seeing these kind of ideas enter the political discourse more than ever before. Candidates are talking about employee ownership, and Elizabeth Warren is talking about the Accountable Capitalism Act, that companies, not only do we need to worry about antitrust or the size of companies, we need to worry about their purpose. And she's saying if you're over $1 billion in revenue, a company needs a new federal charter, and it has a new fiduciary duty to serve the community and the employees as well as shareholders. These are big ideas, and I think we're seeing some game-changing concepts that we haven't seen before. I think it's great.
And can we get, let's say, a change in leadership in 2020? Can we get from now to then?
Well, gosh, that's a big question, isn't it? Hopefully we don't tear ourselves apart. But I think a lot of the chaos that we're experiencing is because, you know, both political, economic, ecological, the economic system that we have is reaching its limits. I mean, you can't have an economic system designed for the 1%. That starts to go off the rails, and that's what we're seeing. But we're not talking about that. There's lots of distracting things we're talking about. But we really see that a need for a different kind of economy is at the root of a lot of the chaos.
The name of the book is The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. The book is by Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard of the Democracy Collaborative. Marjorie Kelly has been our guest. The book is published by BK. Thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Joe, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. Our guest has been Marjorie Kelly. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.